From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Jeremy's out today. It's Here and Now. And the head of NATO today said Britain's defense secretary has assured him that Britain remains fully committed to the alliance with North America and Europe, despite the UK's vote to leave the European Union.
But the markets have been far from reassured about the Brexit, the exit from the EU. In the US, the Dow dropped around 500 points at the open, the biggest drop in 10 months. The S&P and NASDAQ have also taken hits. So what does Brexit mean for the U.S. economy? Michael Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us now. And Michael, first remind us, Britain pulling out, we know investors don't like questions and instability. But what more is going on here? Did Britain somehow prop up the EU financially?
Well, I think, you know, if I were to use one British expression to describe what's going on, it would just be gobsmack. You know, the financial markets are just astounded, surprised, and shocked. This is not how they expected things to turn out. As far as Britain's role in the EU, it is considered one of the financial capitals of Europe. And obviously, this leads to the question of, will it lose that status? Will the big, you know, British banks, American banks, all banks have some sort of presence in Britain, and what that will do to them? All sorts of questions. You know, this is an unprecedented event, right? Obviously. And so there are way more questions than I think anyone can comfortably answer.
Well, the Brits held on to their economy. They held on to the pound as opposed to going to the euro. And the pound is now falling. Investors dumping it, plowing money into the dollar. What does that mean for the U.S.?
You know, it's not the best sign for, say, U.S. manufacturing. Obviously, when the dollar strengthens against other currencies, it makes the products produced here more expensive overseas. And that's part of the reason why the equity markets here are so alarmed. It really raises a lot of questions about the forecasts that companies and analysts have made about sales and profits going forward, and how weak the pound can really get, how strong the dollar can get against all of the other currencies. People really rush into the dollar in troubling times like this. And it's not necessarily the best thing for the domestic economy.
Yeah, we were just saying a while ago that it might be good if you're traveling in Europe and your dollar goes further, but not good for the economy. And what about the ongoing question about the Federal Reserve and whether or not they'd raise interest rates? This might be one more reason for them not to, along with last month's surprisingly low jobs data. So take a look at that. What do you see there?
Yeah, it's absolutely a dramatic shift in the expectation for interest rate increases. As of yesterday, the markets were pricing in about a 50% chance that there would be another increase by the end of the year at the December meeting. Now there's actually a 10% probability that they'll cut rates in July. So it's a certain a tremendous amount of uncertainty, but clearly, you know, the verdict from the financial markets is that they don't expect a Fed rate hike this year, another one.
Well, and that might be good if you're going to take out a mortgage, you know, low interest rate. But what does that mean for business, you know, for the economy, if the Fed even cuts the rate?
Right. Well, again, it's this whole uncertainty factor. Obviously, you know, we can only cut them so far. You know, they're very close to zero now. You know, no one in this country, I don't think, would be too excited about the prospects of going into negative interest rates like they have done in Europe, which is a very controversial thing. You know, they've done it to try to, you know, really spur the lending markets. But there's questions about the effects long term. So in general, yeah, people tend to applaud lower interest rates. But in this case, there's so much else going on that causes people to worry that it's not necessarily the best news.
Mike Regan, I have to say, you sound gobsmacked.
I am gobsmacked, yes.
Yeah, but what are your fears, just in a minute or so?
Well, to me, the biggest fears are the banking system. Again, London is one of the centers of the banking universe, and now there's just so many questions about the inner relationships between banks around the world and how that's all going to play out. Bank stocks, which the big U.S. banks did very well in their stress tests, which were released yesterday by the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. But now there's all sorts of questions about any counterparty risk they have with European banks and how that's all going to work out. It's a very alarming situation.
Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. I want to say thank you, but that doesn't seem appropriate when you're telling us things are so alarming. But thank you.
Thank you.
And the Brexit vote was fueled in part by nationalism and fear of immigration. That sounds familiar to a lot of people in this country. This morning, Donald Trump was in Scotland promoting one of his golf courses. He spent most of his press conference talking about his business, not Brexit. But eventually, he did comment on the vote.
People want to take their country back. They want to have independence, in a sense. And you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just, in my opinion, more than just what happened last night. You're going to have, I think, many other cases where they want to take their borders back. They want to take their monetary back. They want to take a lot of things back. They want to be able to have a country again.
And joining us now is NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley. And Scott, a lot of people thought that Trump was wrong to leave the campaign trail for what was supposed to be a business trip. But actually, it's kind of funny. The timing looks pretty good right now. He's got total control of the news cycle here in the U.S.
Well, that's right. And he, in some ways, there's going to be some criticism of him standing on his golf course and saying a drop in the British pound is good for tourism business here at my golf resort. But certainly, a lot of folks are going to be drawing parallels between his campaign and the successful exit campaign in the UK.
Yeah, you've got to wonder. I mean, the vote, if it would give him some sort of momentum, because it was a validation of the fears that his campaign has been hitting on in this country.
Yeah, I don't think it gives momentum in the sense that someone who was against Donald Trump in this country is now suddenly going to say, you know, maybe I ought to give him a second look. Mm. But certainly what it will do is say that the kind of nativist frustrations that he has capitalized on in this country are serious, they are widespread, and that establishment politicians like London bookmakers minimize those feelings at their peril.
Hmm. You got Hillary Clinton as well in a statement this morning saying that this is a time of uncertainty. It underscores the need for calm, steady, experienced leadership. Are we hearing anything else from Clinton today?
Hillary Clinton's campaign just did a conference call with reporters, and it was one of those conference calls where the questions may have been more telling than the answers. Reporters were peppering the campaign about similarities between Clinton campaign messages and the messages of the unsuccessful Stay campaign in the UK. Even the slogan, like Better Together, there's a real echo between what the unsuccessful Stay campaign in the UK was arguing and the arguments that Hillary Clinton's been making in this country. Now, it's not really just about, you know, the slogans. It's really about the underlying philosophy. Hillary Clinton believes that countries are strongest when they work together. She believes that was true of the UK. She believes that was true of the United States. President Obama made that same argument when he campaigned for the Stay campaign back in April. He said the UK magnifies its influence when it works with the EU. He believes that. Donald Trump and his supporters don't believe in that sort of internationalism. They're more of a sort of every country in its own is out for its own self. And That's a real fundamental difference, and certainly in the UK vote, it shows that every country on its own has a strong following.
It is fascinating. I mean, the parallels between what Donald Trump has been saying, his nationalist conversations, the fear of immigration. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton representing this sort of status quo in the leadership. I think that's important to watch. But the stock markets across the globe are reacting to this, including here in this country. If the United States economy starts going south after the Brexit, who does that benefit or hurt more in the race for president?
Well, Peter, I have to say, if I were a really good forecaster, I would have sold my stocks yesterday. So I'm not take this with a big grain of salt. The simple conclusion is that a struggling U.S. economy is tough for the Democrats. Hillary Clinton is running to as a more of a stay the course type candidate than Donald Trump is. So in theory, the stronger the U.S. economy is, the better it is for Hillary Clinton. The weaker the U.S. economy is, the better it is for Donald Trump. It's possible, though, if you take a sort of second level analysis, that voters might say, well, it was Donald Trump type thinking that caused all this turmoil, and maybe we don't want to go that direction. But I think the simple explanation is usually the one that's more accurate.
So do you see the Clinton camp sort of preparing its own reaction to this?
Well, Hillary Clinton gave a speech earlier this week, even before the UK results were known, where she really did acknowledge a lot of frustration with the status of the U.S. economy. It was a speech that was not about saying, hey, aren't you doing great? Let's stay the course. It was a speech about saying, I understand that there are inadequacies with the economy. I understand that a lot of people are frustrated with their economic situation, but I have better economic prescriptions than Donald Trump does. That was the argument she was making even before the UK vote. I think she's going to be probably polishing those arguments and trying to improve them going forward.
Yeah, well, then there was Bernie Sanders, who has drifted to the sidelines a little bit today, saying that he would vote for Hillary Clinton in November. He said he understood that the economy was not working for everybody in the United States, and it's also not working for everybody in the UK. Interesting, he says he will vote for Hillary Clinton, but still in a way drawing his own distinctions with Hillary Clinton.
Challenge for Hillary Clinton has got to be to say, you know, stay with the party, but expect some new things from me.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Scott Horsley, White House reporter for NPR. Thank you.
Good to be with you on this tumultuous day.
Absolutely. 8 years ago, one of the most powerful women on Wall Street was fired. Sally Krawcheck was head of the wealth management group at Citi. She was pushing the company to give money back to clients who'd lost a lot of it because of Citi's bad investments leading up to the financial crisis. She lost that battle, but now she's got a new job helping women be smarter with their money. She's head of a new investment platform called Elevest. And in this week's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, we speak with Sally Krawcheck, who believes the U.S. is facing a gender investment gap. And I asked her to explain what she meant by that.
We're facing a retirement savings crisis in this country. And if you actually dig through the numbers, it is in large part a women's crisis. That's because we women live longer than you men do. I'm sorry to tell you, Peter.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know. And we actually, we retire with less money than men do. And that's in part because we have, as you just indicated, something that we really haven't been talking about, which is a gender investing gap. Men invest to a greater degree than women do. And it cost us women thousands, some cases hundreds of thousands, for some women, millions of dollars over the course of their lives. It's a big deal.
Well, the asset management firm BlackRock points out that women keep about 70% of their money in cash, and for men, it's about 59%. Just explain why that statistic is so important, the basic idea that cash in a savings account doesn't grow with inflation.
You lose money every day, essentially, that inflation gets ahead of you, and so day by day by day, you have less. Whereas if you're in the markets, the stock markets, which have their ups and their downs, over time, over the last, let's call it, you know, eight decades, has returned on average 9.5% per annum. If you're in a diversified portfolio, which is what we typically recommend at Elevest, you'll get somewhere between those. But, you know, what we as women have to do is we have to change our thinking of, geez, it can be risky to be in the markets, to, geez, it's very risky to be out of the markets because we lose ground.
I want to ask you about this discrepancy. I mean, why women are so much more reluctant to invest than men? Because in some ways, and please tell me if I'm being stereotypical here, I could see why women would be much better investors than men. They might be more patient. They might be less willing to take a risk.
Well, I won't fight you on that because the research indicates that when we women invest, we women do tend to be more patient, take a longer-term perspective, and as a result of it, tend to be better investors than men. But the messages we get are that investing is sort of the guy's world. Think about it for a second. If you think about the investment firms in Wall Street, the messages tend to be male messages: outperform the market, beat the market, pick the winners. The TV shows around investing tend to be sort of sports-like in nature. Heck, the symbol of the industry is actually a bull. And so there's some very male messages. On top of that, we as women tend to buy into some of the old myths. It's really one of the last places where we're more 1958 than 2016. Guys are better at math. Not true. People do tend to think men are better investors. Again, we talked about it, not true. That women need more financial education to invest. Well, everybody does, but men invest anyway. Women need more hand-holding. Women need a personal relationship. There are all these sort of soft biases that keep us back from investing. The truth is the industry simply hasn't spoken to us as fully as it has to men, and it cost us.
And as you know, many of those biases start at a very early age. So I just wonder, how did you learn how to invest?
Ah, how did I learn? I just did it. The reason I started investing is because I went to Wall Street. Truth is, I was a journalism major. And I went to Wall Street because it was the 80s, because I wanted to learn about something to write about. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I, well, frankly, couldn't get a job in journalism, truth be told.
I couldn't get a job on Wall Street.
Well, so there we have it. So sort of two peas in a pod or different sides of the coin or whatever it is. So I was in the industry where that's what we did. So I didn't come by it naturally. I don't know that I would have if I hadn't been part of the industry.
You taught yourself?
I did. Research analyst. And I found that I bought stocks well and then would fall in love with them and forget to sell them. And so I became convinced that the right way to invest is forget about picking the stocks. The research is awfully clear that this is a lot of activity for a lot of underperformance in general, even for professionals, that the right way to invest is to have a diversified portfolio across a range of assets that will lower the volatility and give you market-like returns in theory over time. And that's the way we invest at Elevest, keep it very simple. And rather than talk to the women about, hey, want a large cap mutual fund? No. Want a small cap ETF? Oh, what's that? Mm-hmm. That instead we talk to her about the things she can control, which is how does she want to retire? Does she want to buy a home? Does she want to have a kid? Does she want to start a business? What does she want to achieve in life? We then, through the use of a very powerful algorithm, then project out for her her ability to achieve those things by investing in highly customized investment portfolios to get her there.
Well, you mentioned that you taught yourself how to invest. And I'm just thinking about my own financial education growing up. My father sat me down and talked to me about money and investing very much. I mean, spending hours of my lifetime. I think probably my sister had a very different experience or different types of conversations with my father. I'm certain that my wife had a very different set of conversations in her household growing up. So how do women in their 20s, in their 30s, or maybe even older, get out of that cycle?
Mm-hmm. We just have to break it. And one of my messages to women is, you know, I thought years ago, you know what? I don't really want to exercise. I really don't. But the reason I do it is for my kids to watch me do it, for them to see that it's part of a healthy lifestyle and a life well lived. My work, when I work, I don't spend a lot of time on the work-life balance. I want my kids to see that I love my job and the impact that I can have, that my husband can have on the world around us through our work. I'd say the same thing with investing, that I talk to any number of women and say, we need to do it because you don't want your daughter to be stuck, you know, decades from now, not having invested and then being stuck in the marriage she doesn't like, in the job she hates, doing the things she doesn't want to do because she doesn't have the financial cushion that can be built up through investing that gives her the resources to live the life that she wants to.
And I understand that happened to you, that very thing.
Well, I find it's important to learn every lesson the hard way. And so even though I was on Wall Street in my 20s, my first husband, my ex-husband, who's now with my ex-friend, strayed. Let's just put it that way. He strayed. And I found myself, you know, trying to figure out how much money we had, where it was, et cetera, because he took care of all of this. Now, I will tell you, Peter, for years I told this story and I'd say, look, if my husband could cheat on me, your husband can cheat on you. And frankly, nobody ever found it that compelling. I'm sure the women were thinking, you know, Sally, I don't know. I'd probably cheat on you too. But here I finally figured out a way to make my point, Peter, which is if Jay-Z can cheat on Beyonce, none of us are safe. Okay?
Beyonce has a lot of money, though.
Oh, exactly my point. So when do we feel sorry for her? No. Now, obviously, you know, we'd all love to have that kind of financial cushion. But the point remains the same, which is if you are financially strong, things can happen to you in life and you can weather them much better than if you're not. And I'll give your listeners a statistic that they should take very seriously, which is 90% of women manage their money on their own at some point in their lives. And the tragedy is when a woman is trying to figure it out for the first time because her husband cheated or he died. And so leaving it in someone else's hands, something that is this important, when, by the way, again, the research shows the women outperform the guys on investing, allowing this to be outsourced is an enormous mistake.
Well, I hear you, Sally, but I'm also seeing a new Bankrate.com report that shows 66 million American adults don't have any money saved up for retirement. 28% have saved 6 months of an emergency fund. Makes me think that, you know, maybe this isn't so much a problem about gender, men and women. It's just a problem for everybody.
These problems can coexist because there's no doubt as a country that we are undersaved. There's no doubt as a country that we tend to overspend. And my message for young people, but for everyone, if you have to buy it on a credit card, do not buy it. Look at what your salary is and live within those means. In fact, look at what your salary is, subtract 5%, 10%, 20%, some amount to put aside every week, every month, and live within those means. And that money is going to be put off for, yes, retirement, but also for buying homes, for starting businesses, for having families, for the big things in life, and live within those means overall. But I'd come back to, if there's not enough retirement savings out there, and if we live 6 to 8 years longer than men, you think about it, every nursing home in this country is 80 to 85% female. So by looking at the issue this way, by shifting the lens on it, it's very interesting because all the problems that we think about, all the solutions we think about for the retirement savings crisis, which is entitlement cuts, ugh, tax increases, eh, become more about closing the gender pay gap, keeping women in the workforce longer, closing the gender investing gap, that closing the gender pay gap in and of itself, because it would lead to more Social Security contributions, more 401k contributions, by some estimates closes the retirement savings gap by a third.
Wow.
So these numbers are not small. Remember, women are half plus the workforce. So getting more resources into the hands of women actually leads to closing this gap and economic growth. It's all good.
Sally Krawcheck, CEO and co-founder of the startup Elevest. Sally, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. I appreciate it.
The far right in Europe is praising Britain's vote to leave the EU. French leader Marine Le Pen called it a victory for freedom. Dutch politician Geert Wilders called for a similar vote in the Netherlands. Beatrix van Stoik is a member of the Anti-Immigration Alternative for Germany party. She's also a member of the European Parliament based in Brussels. We caught her on her cell phone at the Brussels airport. And Beatrix, your reaction?
Well, I'm very, very happy that the British people had the opportunity to vote. And they took the opportunity and they voted to leave. I think it's very good to have a referendum, and I'm very much in favor of direct democracy. I think it's important that the people have the chance to vote for what they want. They send a very strong signal to the EU establishment that the ever closer union is not their political concept. And I think this is important because all the other parties in many countries and all the EU elites, they think we have to go for an ever closer union, ending up with a state, with the United States of Europe. And this is what the Europeans don't like. And the movement against it is getting stronger. And today it was a wake-up call, I think, for all those pushing forward to the ever closer union.
Well, your organization is also anti-immigration. But you know the criticism that in the campaigns and a lot of the language in the run-up to the vote, it was seen as xenophobic, racist. Your sense of that?
Well, it's these kinds of attack people are just tired of. If one wants to control its own border, that's not racist. That's just normal. And if you say you can't take something like 1, 2, or 2 million migrants from Northern Africa, for example, for Germany, that's not xenophobic. That's just realistic. We can't take them all. We can't solve the problems of war and civil war and poverty all over the world by taking all those people fleeing into our country. This does not work. And people now reacted in a way to say, okay, if you fight us, we leave.
What about the way the markets are reacting, plummeting around the world? There's, you know, widespread concern that this is going to, you know, be an economic disaster.
Yeah, this is what they said before. And of course, the markets are reacting today. But I think we'll see in a short time that the markets will stabilize again
And Beatrix, we know you're about to get on a plane, so we really appreciate your time. What does this mean for Germany, for your country, taking on, first of all, far more of a leadership role in the EU?
Well, this is, I always made it that way. From the German taxpayer's point of view, it's a very sad day today because the European Union is losing the second biggest net payer. But on the other hand, we think it's good that the British people had the opportunity to decide, and they decided, and this is what we are to have as well, a referendum in Germany.
And do you want Germany to leave as well?
If we do not manage to set up the European treaties completely new, we have to leave because we don't want to give up our sovereignty, and we know that the political concept is to stop the nation states from being nation states and have a United States of Europe, and this is what we do not support. If we don't change the treaties and if we don't make that clear in the treaties that this is not the way we're going to, we have to leave.
Beatrix von Storch, a German parliamentarian, a member of the Alternative for Deutschland, an anti-immigration organization, a member of the Conservative Bloc in the EU Parliament. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Scott.
Tennessee State Rep. Andy Holt isn't backing down on his promise to give away a semi-automatic rifle, a gun very much like the one used in the Orlando slaughter. He's doubling down. He's giving away two. You may have heard, before the shooting at the Pulse nightclub, Representative Holt pledged to give away a rifle as a door prize at Hogfest, this weekend's fundraiser at his family hog farm. But now he's offering two, as he wrote on Facebook the day after the attack. That's right, I'm now giving away two AR-15s. He's not unfamiliar with controversy. He sponsored a bill in his state allowing college employees to carry guns on campus. He's purchased concealed carry permits to give away. But giving away military-style weapons? State Representative Holt joins us now by Skype. Representative Holt, why give away these weapons now, after Orlando?
Yeah, so in response to that, I think that this particular terrorist would love the fact that his actions would have begotten an erosion of constitutional rights for law-abiding Americans. Mm. So what we want to do is we want to say, you know what, first of all, we're going to celebrate the Second Amendment. And really what we're going to do is even more at this point now than ever. We need to recognize that the actions of a nefarious person should not cripple the rights of law-abiding citizens.
Well, it's really interesting that many of the victims, they decided to go back into clubs and celebrate that way. You feel the celebration should be of gun rights, and we know you are set against gun restrictions. Even requiring the people on the terrorism no-fly watch lists, requiring that they not be able to buy a gun, let's take that up for a moment. If there had been such a restriction, with a look back, a five or so year look back, the Orlando shooter wouldn't have been able to get a gun. Why be against people who are on watch lists not being able to buy a gun?
So the watch list is an arbitrary list that's put together by government bureaucrats. And from what I understand, a lot of times we can't even be told exactly why a person goes on a watch list. So at what point do we give over that arbitrary control to bureaucrats?
But there's a process in which you can get off the watch list. I mean, Ted Kennedy had to do it. You're right. There's, you know, there are people on it who shouldn't be on it. And in this case, I mean, it's hard to argue he was on it. Yes, he was released from it. But if there was a look back, which, you know, lawmakers are proposing, he wouldn't have been able to buy a gun.
Well, let's look at the fact that the FBI was contacted not once, not twice, to interview this particular gentleman, but then by the gun salesman who said, I think this gentleman needs to be looked at or something needs to be done. Yeah. Nothing happened.
Well, except no, the FBI went, but they had no license. There was no way to trace that call. But I take your point.
Well, and I think that we need to be careful. I mean, in the same way that I don't want to be profiled by saying, hey, listen, this guy lives in this spot. He's really outspoken and really right leaning. I don't want to just profile and say, well, everyone who is Islamic or everyone who is this or everyone who is that, you know, is going to be specifically profiled. But when an individual meets certain criteria on multiple occasions, then I think it's at that point that FBI investigations or other types of investigations, which are supposed to be enforcing these no-fly lists. But the idea that we would give over our constitutional rights and say, you know what, we don't need to protect ourselves with the intent that the founders gave to us. We'll let government provide that for us. Well, I don't trust that. I don't trust the government to keep my safety in check either.
In your state, Tennessee, firearm salesmen that are not federally licensed don't have to do checks on purchasers. And as you know, Tennessee Democratic Party Chair Mary Mancini wrote in a statement. Well, let's hear her out. She says, responsible gun owners don't put guns in the hands of strangers. Andy Holt doesn't know if he's putting the winning raffle ticket in the hands of the next mass shooter.
Yeah, and I need to respond to that because, first of all, it's not a raffle, technically. And second of all, whoever it is that that wins the door prize of these two rifles, the two individuals, they will have to go through a federal firearms licensing background check.
So let's make it clear, the two people who win, you're going to require that they go through a background check before they get the gun, even though you don't have to do that by law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because here's the thing. Why would we be afraid for anybody to go through a background check if they're a law-abiding citizen?
Well, then why would you be afraid to require them?
Well, I think what we see is that when you do that, what you do is you place a burden on all these folks. There's a significant cost associated with that background check. And that's honestly, a lot of firearms dealers make as much money off the background check as they do off the firearm. So what we see is any inhibition to a lawful individual being able to purchase that firearm, in my opinion, is, again, a further infringement on that right. The Second Amendment clearly says the right shall not be infringed.
Well, let me ask you something, Andy Holt. Right now, the bills that have been attempted in Congress would expand background checks to include gun show sales and online sales. The sale might have to wait for a day or so. You want to do this with the guns you're giving away. Why?
Well, I think that we don't have anything to hide.
But isn't it because, too, don't you really want to be sure who gets that gun you've given away?
Sure. I mean, there's no problem with that. But here's what we have to see is, I mean, in my education, I mean, I'm an economist by trade. What we recognize is that taxes and tariffs, penalties, fees provided by government. Yeah, we could do a background check on every gun everywhere. But what I see is ultimately that leads to a reduction of the opportunity for people to get protection for themselves. I can tell you, I put out a request 5 or 6 days ago, and I said that I would give away 5 concealed carry permits to 5 individuals who would contact my office. We've had over 1,000 phone calls. But do you know that a ton of the folks that called, it really did surprise me. What we see is that anytime we add a cost to a constitutional right, it puts the poorest and those with the least capacity in the most unsafe position. When we increase the cost of possessing a firearm, we decrease the number of lawful firearms that give people the protection and the great equalizer that they need to tackle crime.
Representative Holt, I just have to follow up on this. You know, I'm hearing you say that you'd want to know, you'd want to check and make sure somebody you gave a gun to. I can hear you. I mean, why would you ever want somebody to walk away with a gun you gave them who turns out to be someone who shouldn't have it?
Nobody has the intent that is a lawful gun salesman to put any kind of a lawfully possessed weapon in an unlawful person's hands.
Right, but without a gun background check, you know, how do you know that? Now, you're doing it.
Would you about this? Because, I mean, we can go ahead and end the interview right now. I've made my opinion very clear. Now, obviously, you have your own biased opinion about this.
No. You've triggered a question I didn't know I'd have. Because you're being responsible. I can hear that you care. You're a public person. You've got a reputation. You want to make sure that this gun doesn't get into the wrong hands. How is it that you wouldn't require people who don't have that same sense of responsibility you have, require them to do it?
Because we've done it for years and years and years, and probably hundreds of millions of firearms have been exchanged in that capacity. And guess what? The vast, vast, vast majority of those firearms have never been used for nefarious purposes.
We understand that your family, your staff, you've received death threats.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, in my tenure as a state representative, death threats have been a pretty common occurrence, unfortunately for me. I mean, we've had calls to our home threatening the life of my wife and children. Mm. And my views on traditional family values, traditional marriage and things like that have begotten me several death threats as well. But this particular situation, which is extremely odd, is that people who are anti-gun are calling and threatening gun violence on me as a sitting state legislator.
Well, that's scary. That's scary. You know, people on the other side of this debate have also received death threats. You know that. The woman who founded Moms Demand Actions for Gun Control has armed men showing up ominously at her events. Her kids' accounts have been hacked. They've all had their lives threatened.
It's scary.
And that's ridiculous. Yeah. There's no reason for that whatsoever. Yeah. My defense of a constitutional right, I don't think should get me death threats. And a person's free will and their constitutional First Amendment right to say what they wish, I don't think that should get them a death threat either.
No.
So I think we just live in a very polarized country right now, especially on some of these issues.
Well, I guess the question just is, it's very frightening. The question is, doesn't that give you some pause to consider maybe some tamping down of emotions instead of deliberately provoking them by giving away two guns that have been associated with so much pain?
That's not a fair statement at all.
No?
To say that I'm provoking, I am defending a constitutional right. I think that the erosion of any constitutional right begets further erosion of other constitutional rights.
Andy Holt, who represents District 76 in the Tennessee Assembly, I do thank you so much, Representative Holt, for your time.
Thank you, ma'am.
A report out today from the U.S. Conference of Mayors provides a snapshot of how cities are doing economically. It says most of the jobs lost in the Great Recession have come back and wages are on the rise. But there are parts of the country, like the industrial Midwest, that are not doing as well. Mick Cornett is the mayor of Oklahoma City, and he's the incoming president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which holds its annual meeting in Indianapolis this weekend. And Mayor, Oklahoma's budget has been crushed by the falling price of oil. How does that trickle down to you there in Oklahoma City?
You know, Oklahoma City is kind of a unique story in that energy is now only 3% of our employment base. And I think that surprises a lot of people. So we're no longer as heavily reliant on energy as we used to be. We've been very successful in growing jobs in the fields of aviation and biomedical. And we have a tourism market that we didn't have 10 or 20 years ago.
But it's not really the same story across the state. I mean, as you know, Oklahoma had a big budget problem this year. 200 teachers in your city lost their jobs. Students were walking out of the classroom to protest it. So how are the money problems, broadly speaking, playing out in other cities in the state?
Well, what you're seeing is a state government that really needs to hit the reset button on how they generate revenue so that they're not so reliant on the energy industry. And a lot of the energy jobs in those rural areas have gone away, and a lot of those young people that have held those jobs are now moving to Oklahoma City where the jobs are. So it is an issue for the state. You know, the state is more reliant on the energy industry than I wish they were. But in Oklahoma City, our economy is much more diversified.
What other cities across the country do you think are doing something similar? Because when I look at the map, I can tell that Louisiana is struggling, Wyoming, some cities in Texas and West Virginia are hurting. Where are you seeing, you know, shining examples across the country of cities dealing with that problem, diversifying their economy?
I think if you look south to Texas, you see areas like Dallas and Austin, Texas, that have done a really good job of diversifying. And as Washington kind of retreats on its, you know, mechanisms that send money down to cities, you're going to see more winners and losers at the city level. I think all the money that came out of Washington years ago was kind of a leveling out factor. And so you are going to see some cities that leave other cities behind.
Well, let's talk more about that, because if you look at some major cities across the country, they're kind of going on their own. You've got Philadelphia passing the soda tax recently. Some cities are banning plastic bags. The minimum wage is an issue that cities across the country are taking on their own. What is that about? Do you think that mayors are as frustrated as some regular citizens are with their state legislatures, with the federal government?
I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, mayors and people that look after cities are frustrated at the stagnation. Where cities are going to have to get some help, and, you know, so far the help doesn't seem to be arriving, is on the infrastructure side. Mm. You've got a lot of decaying infrastructure, especially in the eastern part of the United States, and there doesn't seem to be any solution on the way. You know, this is a ticking time bomb in America, and we've got to do something about the infrastructure needs of this country.
Let me just ask you a political question. We're in the thick of the 2016 race right now. You're in a very conservative red state in Oklahoma. What are people's feelings there about Donald Trump?
Well, I think we're pretty conservative here. Certainly, Secretary Clinton is, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of following here. But I don't know that Donald Trump so far has addressed the things that we're concerned about.
Well, like what? What do you want to hear from him?
Well, for instance, from a mayoral perspective, you know, what is he going to do about the nation's infrastructure issues? What is he going to do about mental health? What type of an agenda does he have for urban America? You know, what we're seeing on the presidential campaign is you know, pretty outlandish, and it's just, you know, political theater. None of it is the real policy-oriented, you know, steps that mayors are used to. We're about getting things done. It's like our politics have become a reality television show, and that's no way to run a country.
Well, if you don't end up hearing what you want to hear from Donald Trump, will you vote for him anyways?
Well, we will insist to hear from him, you know, by the time November gets here. You know, you can't ignore the nation's cities, you know, forever.
Well, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer will be speaking at your meeting this weekend. Of course, he'll be talking about the shooting in his city. I wonder, you're from Oklahoma City, a place that knows very well what a terror attack feels like. What advice would you have for Mayor Dyer now 21 years after the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, Oklahoma City's experience, looking back, was that the bombing was sort of a unifying emotional effort. I don't think any city's come as far as fast as Oklahoma City has. It's an extremely difficult thing to get through. I think, to a certain extent, you have people who try to move on too fast. But from Oklahoma City's experience, from a big picture perspective, looking back, it was a very important unifying moment in our city's history, and it's as if we grabbed hands and pulled each other up and dared the world to pull us apart.
You kind of do get the feeling that that sort of thing is happening already in Orlando as well. Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett, you're the incoming president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Your meeting, annual meeting this weekend. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.